Geekscape.com.
The Races of America, Part 3. Spanish Conquest and Policy. The Negro, the natural, typical, uncorrupted Negro, never resists the white man, for he is a blank, a child, a creature that has nothing to overcome, and therefore, the very day he arrives from Africa, he goes to work under the overseer as if he had been thus engaged all his life. But even this simple, innocent, and easily ruled creature has a certain moral sense that, when cultivated and appealed to, renders him far more useful and available as an element of our modern civilization. And this want was met by the planter's family, who, without even being pious in the ordinary sense, still had a certain interest and a certain moral responsibility in regard to their Negro people, or so-called slaves. The Negro minister on a plantation was almost always worse than his people. But the plantation that was under the charge of a white clergyman, or some ordinary pious family, was always the best regulated, and the people the most useful. This was strikingly presented by the late, eminent, and lamented Dr. Cartwright, who, a large sugar grower himself, instituted inquiries on the subject, and found that though Louisiana was not, strictly speaking, a sugar region, and Cuba was, nevertheless, the labor of two Negroes in the former was equal to that of three Negroes in the latter. This was because of the moral influence of the planter's family, who often, perhaps generally, regarded the Negro as humble and dependent members of such family. At all events, there was always, even with the worst masters, a certain recognition of a moral sense in his Negro people, while in Jamaica, Cuba, all the West Indian islands, where they depended on the slave trade instead of natural increases, the Negro was regarded in the light of a mere work animal, and in most cases, the moral element in these people was disregarded altogether. The church in Spanish America filled this want, or appealed to the moral element in the native, and thus civilized them, and rendered them available as laborers to the great proprietors. Protestantism could not do this, for though William Penn, the Moravians, and a few other isolated cases may be presented, the effort to civilize the Indians, since the landing at Plymouth and Jamestown, is an admitted failure. The Spanish conquest would have proved equally futile without the aid of the church. They would have conquered and exterminated, that is all, just as have the Protestants of the North. No doubt there are very sincere Protestant missionaries, but whether in our own Western territories, the Sandwich Islands, the East Indies, or Africa, the result is the same, and the sole instances where they are most successful, as in the Sandwich Islands, they are the most fatal to the native, for just there they most rapidly reform them off the face of the earth. But what, then? Does it follow that Protestantism is wrong or incapable of doing good to the lower races? No, indeed. It only shows that its missionaries wholly mistake the nature of their converts, just as those parents, whose vanity prompts them to have smart children, teach them often to study mathematics and stunt their growth, if not destroy their lives. A missionary begins with a school, of all things the most baneful, and then demands that his victim shall expand into his own intellectual standard, a thing just as absolutely absurd as if he demanded that the Negro colour, or hair, or any other physical quality should be like his own. The sole instance where Protestantism has succeeded is the Protestant master of the South, who, setting the Negro a good example, all those imitative powers that God has endowed him with are fully developed, and all that the moral nature of the Negro permits has a healthy development. But save in this case, where the family, rather than the minister, has made Christian and useful beings out of African savages, the civilization of the lower races by Protestantism has been an utter failure, and will probably remain so forever. Its very excellences, its high standard, its intellectual as well as moral demands render it not only useless, but fatal to these subordinate people, and it may be doubted, as regards our Indians in the West, which was the most fatal, rum or the missionary, the Indian trader, who rapidly destroys them by his trade, or the missionary, who kills them with his Bibles and schools. 40 years ago, it was found that the people of the Sandwich Islands would be demoralized by whalers and other sea-going adventurers, but if they had been left to confront this danger, and no missionary had ever visited these islands, it is certain the population would be vastly larger than it is now. Life itself is the greatest blessing that God has given his creatures, for it includes all others. And therefore, when, as in the case of the natives of this continent and the Sandwich Islands, it is seen that they are perishing from the earth, surely thoughtful and honest men will halt and examine into the causes of such fatality. The Catholic missionaries, even if no more earnest or devoted men than their Protestant rivals, were able to adapt their religious machinery to the nature and moral wants of the native, and their success is in many respects the most wonderful page in all history. They Christianized and civilized the New World, for in truth, all that Protestantism has done in this respect is a blank, there being no single instance on record where the Protestant missionaries have preserved the natives after converting them. It is, of course, difficult to get at an even approximating facts, but it is reasonable to say that after the conquest and civilization of the natives, they increased more rapidly within the Spanish dominion than they did before the Spanish advent. The early European writers represent that millions of these people were slain by the invaders, but indeed very few perished, and after the church interfered and civilized them, there was profound peace and harmony everywhere between the conquerors and the conquered. As soon as this first great work was done, the Spanish adventurers went to work, opening mines, plantations, making roads and building cities, works that, even in the present dilapidated condition of things, excites our wonder and even our awe at their extent and grandeur. Churches and convents were erected everywhere, and the natives, profoundly impressed with the belief that the priests were their true friends and powerful protectors, became peaceable and useful laborers everywhere within the Spanish dominion. Agriculture was never developed in any kind of proportion to the actual capabilities of these countries, but the native was as yet the sole laborer. The early Spanish conquerors differed radically from those of England in the north, or even the French in Canada, and instead of any feeling of disaffection to the mother country, or any demand for religious liberty, they were the most favoured and most loyal, and perhaps even the most religious or most Catholic portion of their countrymen. They were simply enterprising adventurers, who, having first discovered a new world, thought themselves its fitting rulers, and save the lust of gold, which impelled them into crimes at times, they were as earnest to exalt the king by new possessions and their church by Christianizing the natives, as they were intent upon improving their own individual fortunes. But as time advanced, and a considerable white and mixed Creole population grew up, Spain became jealous of her own offspring, just as did England in the north. But indeed the latter had good cause of this kind from the first, as her expatriated children had been disowned, and to a certain extent driven from the family fireside. but the early Spanish emigrants were the darlings of the nation, and the new luster they had given the Spanish crown rendered them favourites among all classes of the Spanish people. Nevertheless, a time came when the mother country became jealous of the mighty power growing up in the Western Hemisphere, a power that furnished nearly all the gold and silver of Europe, and that threatened, sooner or later, to overshadow the very people it had sprung from. And curiously enough, this feeling kept equal pace with the decadence of Spain as a European power. The defeat and expulsion of the Moors, the marriage of Ferdinand and Isabella, the union of Castile and Aragon, and the wonderful genius of the great emperor, Charles V, and above all the discovery and conquest of a new world, rendered Spain, on the accession of Philip II, the greatest power in Christendom. And apparently it remained so during the reign of Philip, but setting himself up as the champion of the church, and more intent on putting down Protestantism than increasing or preserving the mighty power his great father had left him, he in fact squandered the latter, in vain though chivalrous efforts to uphold the cause of the church. From Philip's death, the decay of the Spanish power was rapid and continuous, and, as observed, in precise proportion as Spain declined and the Indies increased in importance, was the jealousy of the mother country increased towards her American offspring. Laws were enacted, or rather decrees were enforced, that finally reduced her American children to complete and disgraceful vassalage. Captain generals were sent out with instructions that never could be even known to the Americans, for everything was in secret. All the Americans were permitted to know was that they were absolute rulers, and there could be no appeal against their rule, however cruel or inhuman. Thus, the very descendants of those who had conquered a new world and given Spain a prestige and power unequalled in Christendom were denied all the rights which in Spain were tolerated in the lowest and most dependent classes. They could hold no position under the local government, no matter what their name, wealth, fortune, or fitness, and none but native Spaniards were permitted to hold any office, however humble. Most of the Spanish emigrants, being unmarried, sought alliances with the native women, and there soon grew up large mongrel populations, but still a very considerable Creole population of pure Caucasians existed in the country. The white and mixed people, save the few great landed proprietors and the priests, composed the city populations, and at the close of the last century, when New York and Boston and other Atlantic cities were scarcely more than what we would now call villages, Mexico, Panama, Lima, Puebla, Veracruz were great cities overflowing with wealth, progress, and prosperity. On the coast and in some of the valleys of the Terra Templada, Negroes had been introduced, and in the neighbourhood of Veracruz and further down the coast, extensive sugar plantations were in successful operation. But the productive forces of Spanish America were essentially Indian. There were great wrongs and oppressions practiced on the native Creole population, but the Indian people were usually treated well by the captain generals, and back of them stood the church, the always faithful friend and potent protector of the Indian population. The hybrids and mixed people of the cities were perhaps watched by the Spanish officials with much the same jealous apprehension with which they regarded the native white people, but the aboriginal people, the pure Indians, were generally treated humanely by all classes of Spanish officials. The sole antagonism that existed, and finally that expanded into a revolution, was that between the Spaniards and the native white people. But this was so closely watched by the home government that there was no outbreak, nor indeed interruption, to the general prosperity until Spain, invaded by Napoleon, was forced to fight desperately for her own independence when the native white people saw a chance, as they believed, to cast off the Spanish dominion forever. In 1808, as soon as they heard of Napoleon's occupation of Madrid with a French army, outbreaks took place in several of the captain generalships, the most important of which was that of Morelos in Mexico. These were put down with terrible cruelty by the Spaniards, but they continued to resist, and when driven from the towns and plains, the patriots sought shelter in the mountains, often impassable and impregnable to the regular Spanish troops. The Creole white population had most cause for casting off the Spanish dominion. Indeed, this was the only class that felt the Spanish rule severely, but it was to be expected that the mixed populations would respond to the sentiment of independence, which finally became the dominant feeling of all classes. There was really no cause for the native Indian population to get rid of the Spanish power, and most likely it was a mere impulsive movement of the more energetic and intelligent white and mongrel elements that carried it onwards to the final overthrow of the Spanish dominion. When this movement for independence began, the whole of Spanish America was peaceful and prosperous. They had been much troubled by English privateers, which from the time of Elizabeth and Sir John Hawkins had scourged the Spanish coast towns and slain and plundered the people. But otherwise, the whole of Spanish America was peaceful and prosperous after the first conquest down to the beginning of this century. And while the English colonists were engaged in desperate wars and exterminating the native Indian people, the Spaniards, having Christianized and civilized as well as conquered them, were at peace, and the Indians, instead of dying out, were constantly increasing in most of the countries under the dominion of the Spanish flag. There are no reliable data in existence, but under all the circumstances that combined together make up the case, it is reasonable to suppose that the native Indian population was larger at the beginning of this century than at the time of the conquest. But be this as it may, the whole of Spanish America was peaceful and orderly and productive and prosperous when that great and fatal movement came, which finally ended in independence and the establishment of the Spanish American republics on this continent. This new regime was so widely different and has resulted in such fatal consequences that it is worthwhile to deal with it in a separate chapter and altogether from another standpoint.
You're listening to Radio Aryan at RadioAryan.com.